Welcome to Speaking Out for the Blind. I'm Brian McKellen. Lori Rubin is a famous blind opera singer. She performs live on stage to filled opera houses and music events. Miss Lori Rubin has also sold albums of her performances. Aside from the music business, Lori Rubin sells her own handcrafted jewelry, and she just published her new memoir titled Do You Dream in Color? Lori Rubin comes to Speaking Out for the Blind to share her journey in the music world and her pursuit of other creative talents. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Oh, just fine, thank you.
So first, I want to ask you all about your opera career. How did you decide to become a mezzo-soprano opera singer?
Well, it was kind of in a bunch of steps, and the first was that I loved classical music as a young child, and my father used to play it on our stereo system because in the 80s, that was the music that really, really featured the sound on those stereos the best. So I really just loved it and gravitated to classical music. And later on, I was taking piano lessons, but my piano teacher, you know, had noticed that I wasn't really practicing, which is, that's a lot of our story, I think. But so eventually what happened was that she suggested that I take voice lessons because I was actually singing along with the music that she would be playing. And so I started in voice lessons. And actually, I started in pop music. That's sort of the default that most kids start with because, you know, most teachers wouldn't assume that their students would want to do classical. And of course, I sang the things at the time like Wind Beneath My Wings and Memory from Cats and a lot of hits of the late 80s. But then I saw Phantom of the Opera, and that really changed my life because I realized that I wanted to sing music like that. And even though it was a musical, the whole play is about opera. And so I decided that I just wanted to really start singing opera. And I started with the pieces from Phantom. And then my voice teacher, who actually was an opera singer herself, said, well, you know, Lori, why don't we try classical? And so it snowballed from there.
And speaking of your teachers and your parents, not only did your father and those few music teachers, including your blind school music teachers, influence you into music, but also your mother, and even, believe it or not, I heard this on a NPR show that you were interviewed on, the Diane Rehm show. Even a soft rock singer, Kenny Loggins. And they all influenced you to pursue a career in music. How did even these other people, including Mr. Kenny Loggins himself, influence you into music?
Well, Kenny actually was somebody that my mother used to listen to all the time. She started with Loggins and Messina, that duo that he was in, and eventually moved into just his solo stuff. And so we would listen to him in the car, and I would have all these questions. I'd say, how does he harmonize with himself? And, you know, how can there be more than one Kenny singing at a time? And, of course, I was just 4 years old. And my mom said, well, I don't know. But one day she was at the market, and I remember thinking, oh, it was the one day I wished that I had gone with her to the market. And I had been at home, and she came back and she said, you know, I just met Kenny Loggins at the market. And I told him, and I was like, I couldn't believe it. And I said, so tell me. And she said, my daughter is into your music. And of course, you know, I guess talking about a 4-year-old blind child was more interesting than saying, oh, I'm your biggest fan, you know. So he was touched by that and said that we could go see his concert at the Universal Amphitheater and head backstage after, and that's when we met him. And of course, all the questions I had about his harmonizing and all the things that I had wondered totally died on my lips. I was completely dumbfounded when I was meeting him. And we eventually just became groupies. We would go to all of his concerts in Lake Tahoe because we had a condo there. We spent a lot of time backstage at Caesar's Palace with his band and his family. We eventually went snow skiing with him and water skiing. And finally, he asked me to sing on his album, which was called Leap of Faith. So we did that. I sang a little solo on one of the songs called If You Believe. And if you get to the very end of the song, you can actually hear just me singing this tiny, tiny little scat solo. And in terms of my music teacher having an influence in my life from Francis Blend, the school for the blind I went to, she was a fantastic teacher in that she had all of us, she exposed all of us to all kinds of different music, including Peter and the Wolf, where the instruments play the various different characters, like the cat and the duck. And so I really, as a young child, got to distinguish the different instruments and what they sounded like and their personalities. And she had all of us, each child, hold a different instrument from the orchestra so that we would know exactly what we were hearing when the music would be played. Like, it wouldn't just be like listening to something on the radio. We would actually be able to envision people playing the clarinet or the trombone because we would have felt and the instrument and tried to play it and everything. So it was really, that really helped music come alive. So those were my two earliest mentors, I think.
According to the National Endowment for the Arts, I was looking at their website. There are several different opera voice types. Yours is mezzo-soprano, but there are many different types. Bass, tenor, contralto, soprano. Why don't you tell our audience briefly about each of these voice types and just a little bit about how they differ from each other?
Okay, well, the bass is the is definitely the lowest. And that, you can hear these really resonant, deafening tones in the bass voice. It's pretty amazing. And when you hear them speak, it's very booming. The baritone is slightly higher, but still a deep voice. And actually, the bass tends to play like the bad guy a lot of times, the older person, the older man, the wise person. And the baritone is a slightly higher voice. The baritone is often the comic character, and, you know, sometimes also wiser. And the tenor is the highest of the male voices, well, with the exception of countertenor, but the tenor is one of the highest male voices. And that is usually the ingenue, or the male ingenue, or the love interest, or the sort of serious male character that you're supposed to fall in love with and feel sorry for and the whole thing. The contralto is a very deep, rich, ballsy woman's voice. It's very heavy. They sing a lot of very dramatic roles with heavy orchestration. And they tend to play sometimes the older lady or the wife, or it's, I mean, there are some very, there's some really incredible roles for contralto. Usually not, I mean, they can be comic, but a lot of times they're very serious and just, they do often steal the show because the voice is so interesting. The mezzo is slightly higher, but the voice does sit in a more, a little bit lower than a soprano, and it tends to have a richer, chocolatier color to it. You can definitely tell a mezzo from a soprano. It's just deeper. And a soprano has the highest voice type. It sits higher in the, and it a lot of times you can tell a soprano because the high notes just waft. They feel like they're stratospheric and you don't feel like there's any effort going into them. And they tend to play the love interest and the ingenues a lot of times. There's so many different kinds of sopranos. But the mezzo that I am, there's a lot of roles for mezzo, but they tend to be sometimes also more comic, and sometimes they play men. Mezzos play prepubescent boys that are, you know, that may be in love, but they might just be coming into their own, like very young boys. And so we have some very interesting roles, and I've kind of liked the gender-bending aspect of mezzo. And there are some very virtuosic passages for mezzo. They tend to kind of, like a dancer would dance all over the stage and be very, very flexible. There are some mezzo roles where you can do that with your voice, and you run all over the music, and you're fast. Your voice is fast-moving all over the music. And so that's the kind of stuff that I sing. So Handel and Rossini, a lot of Baroque stuff, a lot of early Italian romantic stuff is like that, which they call the bel canto period. And that's sort of the rundown of the voice type.
So after you took all the voice lessons and took all the college courses, high school music classes, and you grew in those opera singing skills, how did you finally get the top spot after engagements?
Well, that is something that's, you know, that that was definitely a struggle for a while, because there were so many people that were a little afraid and gun shy of having me on stage. A, because they were afraid I'd be a liability, and B, just because they just had a hard time seeing a blind person in a regular role. Because I think a lot of us who are blind realize that a lot of people in general, a lot of society thinks of us as being desexualized, asexual, not having a normal life, which, you know, couldn't be further from the truth. But I think, you know, this is the sort of the disconnect that, that artists and opera directors might have. So it was difficult, but what the wonderful thing that did happen is that I did, through doing summer programs, through making connections in college, just through singing in New York and people hearing me and just getting exposure, I found directors that wanted to work with me because they actually chose to use my blindness as an opportunity rather than a deterrent. And they thought, wow, you know, that we're going to just really enjoy this aspect of a person. And this doesn't make a person a lesser person. It just adds to the fabric of this person. And so I was very lucky. I found there's this one young man named Ted Huffman who started the Greenwich Music Festival in Connecticut. And he had me sing a couple of lead opera roles there. And he's directing at the Metropolitan Opera. He's conducting at Royal National Opera House. And so he's the kind of person that I'm expecting, you know, will, you know, when I start to want, you know, to sing in those places, that they'll want to work with me, at the Met and all those other places. But, you know, and I've met so many composers too. There was one composer who wrote an opera and I sang the lead role. So I kind of entered through the back door because I learned the role, and because I had already learned the role, New York City Opera hired me to sing it because it was a hard role to sing. It was all, the rhythm was crazy, the melody was difficult. So instead of having a new singer learn it, they just had me do it. So there have been various different ways that I've entered the opera stage, and it's usually not the cookie cutter route. It's usually not just by auditioning, because when you audition as a blind person and you walk into the room, a lot of times people, all they can see is the blindness. And so it's had to be through people who knew me better, people who knew who I was, people who had heard me before, people who had heard things through the grapevine about what kind of a musician I was. And that's how I've gotten most of the really exciting gigs.
So talk about these top engagements mm-hmm. you've performed at. I got a little list here. You sang Haydn's okay. Harmonic Mass with the Oakland East Bay Symphony, the Berlioz Les Nuits d'Été with the Burbank Philharmonic Orchestra, and Barber's Knoxville Summer of 1915 with the Oberlin College Orchestra under mm-hmm. the baton of one of the greatest movie composers of all time, John Williams.
Right. Well, there's some interesting stories. So the first one I think you mentioned was the East Bay Symphony. The reason I got that gig was because I had the great fortune of singing a duet recital with the world-renowned mezzo-soprano Friederike von Stade. And she actually sings a lot of those mezzo roles I was talking about, the pants roles, young boy roles, the really, really florid roles. And I had met her through a voice teacher. And she had heard a CD of mine, and a couple years later she had asked me to sing a duet concert with her in San Francisco. And at that time, she had me over at her house, and she had the conductor, Michael Morgan, of the Oakland East Bay Symphony to hear me. And a year later, he asked me to sing in the Haydn, so that's how I got hired for that one. So that was a pretty exciting opportunity. The Berlioz Nuit d'Été, I auditioned for a competition called the Burbank. It was actually more of a community orchestra in Los Angeles, and they have a competition. And so I auditioned for that and received and won the vocal competition and sang with them. And actually the really special nice thing about that story is that my partner, Jenny Tyra, auditioned and she won on clarinet. So the two of us both performed in that same concert. So that was really special. And then in terms of John Williams, I got to sing with him because the Oberlin Orchestra was the voice studios were submitting tapes for the singers from the top singers from their studios. They wanted to submit for John Williams to decide and to select from, for that concert at the Getty Museum. And John Williams apparently selected my tape, and I was thrilled and honored, but extremely nervous. And that's how I got to work with him. And he was actually a very down to earth, nice, very warm person. So I was very lucky.
So you also secured some record deals with Bridge Records Incorporated to do your mm-hmm. recent album with your new book, Do You Dream mm-hmm. in Color? Starkland mm-hmm. to release your second album, Target, and Opera mm-hmm. Omnia to release your first mm-hmm. album, Faith in Spring.
Yes. So Opera Omnia, that happened actually in 2005, and it was a very exciting opportunity because there was this wonderful, very famous art song coach named Graham Johnson. He plays for a lot of singers on recordings of Schubert and Fauré and Schumann and Brahms, all kinds of things. And so he and I had been working together. He had actually been my coach for working on some of that German repertoire. And he actually recommended me to this record label, and I subsequently went to London to record that album. And it was so fun because it was actually really, really nerve-wracking too, because it was only 5 days. You have to record like 67 minutes of music in like these really, really short recording sessions. And, you know, you want to make every detail perfect because it's going to be on CD forever, you know? And so that's the first one. That's how that one came to be. Starpland was actually, through a composer friend named Kirill Makin. For years, voice teachers had been telling me, Lori, don't sing new music. It's bad for you, because a lot of new music nowadays is very, it's out there, you know, like people would listen to it and they go, oh, what is that, you know? And also sometimes it tends to be a little bit taxing on the voice. But I was very lucky to work with somebody named Dawn Upshaw, who's a wonderful, very famous soprano for doing new music. And she helped me sing that music helpfully. And actually that's where I met Kirill Makin, who wrote a piece called Target for me. Target is actually about the aftermath of 9/11. It's actually has some of the texts from the leaflets that were dropped on Afghanistan from America. So with a lot of that propaganda, and it actually has some descriptions of that time. So it was a really, really heart-wrenching piece. And Kirill, this composer, was offered a record deal from Starkland. And for that record deal, he was offered for the title track to be the piece that I had been doing with him. So I got to, the opportunity to record that, and for that to be on his CD Target. And the Bridge Records one came along, and this is the most interesting story to me, is that the composer Bruce Adolph, who many of you might have known from the Piano Puzzlers, which is it's a show on National Public Radio in which the composer gives you a piece of music that he has totally changed. So it could be like Hey Jude, and Hey Jude would be hidden in the texture of what he was playing, and he would disguise it in a style of a different composer. So you might hear like a Bach fugue that is supposed to sound like Hey Jude. And so a caller calls in and says, okay, I think the composer he's trying to emulate is Bach, and I believe the piece I'm hearing somewhere there is Hey Jude. So Bruce has become very famous for that. And he's also a very well-known composer in his own right. And I had done a concert with him, and he said to me, Lori, I'd love to write a piece for you, and I'd love it to be about I would love you to write a poem for me about your life as a blind artist, and I'll set it to music. And I was just, you know, I was a little resistant, and I hemmed and hawed about it. I didn't want to write about being blind because I felt like it's going to be hokey. I don't want people to pay attention to my blindness all the time as a musician. I just want to be thought of as a musician. But then I thought, you know what? This is an opportunity for me to write about myself, for me to talk about my experiences so that people will answer all the questions that are part of that elephant in the room, and then the blindness can just melt away and just break the ice. So I wrote this poem. And when Bruce set it to music, he approached Bridge Records because he knew the people at Bridge. Bridge fell in love with the idea of the poem and the song, and that became the start of the new CD with them. And there's actually another blind composer on the CD, and that's Joaquin Rodrigo, which a lot of people don't know he's blind. But I'm really happy he's on that CD because I wanted people to know that he's a blind composer. And yet that he doesn't have to be known as blind. He's just known as a composer.
Let's take a break from the music and talk about your vision. How did you become blind?
Well, I have a condition that's called Leber's amaurosis. And it's actually, what it means is that my retina has never developed. So I've never had sight. I only have light perception.
Our audience wants to know, how do you travel to all of these performances and get up and down the stage as a blind person?
Well, in some cases, I walk with a sighted guide. In some cases, in opera, you know, we'll work on it in advance. So I will know exactly where the stage is, kind of like how you know your own house and don't have need assistance. That's how I travel around the stage. I know that, say, a table's going to be in one place, and then I walk a little bit, maybe a few steps forward, and there might be a rug, and then I go to the right, and there might be, you know, a tray of dishes or whatnot. So it's just, you know, I get to learn where everything is. And if there are parts of, you know, the staging that are dangerous and there's lots of people running around, the director might have somebody just make sure that they're with me so that, you know, I'm out of the way of that stuff. But yeah, there's just a lot of, there are times actually that I'll use a landmark. Let's say I have to walk a straight line. So I might use the edge of a rug to get from point A to point B just so I know where I'm going and I have a frame of reference.
So tell me about your new book, Do You Dream in Color? You released it last October. What's the story about, and why did you decide to give your book that title?
Okay, well, the story of Do You Dream in Color is it's about it's about my life as a blind artist. So it actually details my story from when I was born and through modern time, actually. And it actually details the times that I would go water skiing and snow skiing and doing all those things independently, through the difficulties of middle and high school, through the interesting times and the wonderful times of college where I felt like I could really be myself and where I started to learn about who I was as a singer. And it details a lot of the experiences that I've had professionally. And so there's a lot of things that happen in the book, and I think what people will gain from it, both sighted and blind, is that it's a universal story. It's not a story of a blind person. It's the story of a person who has triumphs and struggles and challenges and emotional breakdowns, just like everybody else. And yes, some of this was triggered by blindness, so there's a lot of stuff in the book to be informative and to sort of get sighted people to think about things they may not have otherwise thought about. But really, I really wanted to detail a more of a universal story that anybody could relate to. And the reason I call it Do You Dream in Color is because throughout the book, I have little poems in which I describe what colors mean to me. So for example, there might be a chapter about the color red. And I started it with this poem about red, and then it leads into my experience with John Williams singing the Knoxville Summer of 1915 with the Oberlin Orchestra because I wore a red gown. So the colors always tie into my experience of the chapter. And it's to weave the colors in is to really show people that blind people can have colorful experiences. And the reason I call it Do You Dream in Color is because I always challenge people to think, no matter what, you know, what their challenge is, even if it sounds paradoxical, do they dream the things, do they think about their dreams, and do they think about how they can accomplish their dreams? And dreaming in color for a blind person might seem like a complete paradox, but for me, I do have a very colorful and rich and wonderful life, and so that question really does put the challenge to the reader to dream in ways that they think may not be possible for themselves.
Okay, so let's real quickly now talk about your jewelry making work. You have your own website, thelrlook.com, and you sold several necklaces and earrings and other jewelry, and you've actually made them. How did you decide to get into the jewelry business, and how do you make your own jewelry as a blind person?
Okay. Well, in 2006, I was living in New York City for already a year. And I remember feeling that, you know, I was just getting started. I was a young singer, so people didn't know who I was yet. I didn't even know who I was yet. And, you know, getting a normal job was difficult. I did go to some blind organizations where they teach you how to do interviews and, you know, you meet with all these different executives from different companies. But, you know, I just knew that getting a job was going to be difficult, and I really wanted to be a working person. I wanted to feel like I had some worth besides being a singer, which wasn't paying the bills at the time. And so I had a friend, actually it was a friend of my mom's who came to New York, who showed me some bracelets she had made. And she explained to me that actually when she made jewelry, that it wasn't visual. It was very tactile. And that inspired me to take some classes at the Jewish Community Center nearby in jewelry making. And I actually asked the teacher of the classes to teach me privately so that she could show me hands-on how to do all the techniques from crimping a necklace to wire wrapping and securing a pendant and all those kinds of things. And that's really how it began. And the way I started picking my own stones out is for years, I've always loved style and color, and I was so excited to get my hands on beads in a bead store, and stones and crystals and all kinds of metal work. And that's, I was like a kid in a candy store picking stuff out, making my own designs based on the textures and the shapes I wanted. And after years of knowledge of knowing the colors, and then those techniques that I had learned from that lady really, really came to great use. And I started making my own jewelry. And my first jewelry show was in the very home of the lady who really inspired me to start making jewelry. She had a little jewelry show for her friends and was very successful. And so I started going around New York and showing my jewelry to some boutiques that I used to go to. And so I had some of my jewelry on consignment there. And it just sort of snowballed from there. And you know, because of the radio interviews that I've been doing, because of my book, I've been getting lots of jewelry orders. And so I've been spending a lot of time recently filling orders, which has been sort of a dream of mine for a long time, because that's, you know, the whole idea. I wanted to make jewelry for all sorts of different people. And putting my design, my excitement about design into practice.
So before we go, would you like to sing a little for us?
I'm not sure it would sound so good over the phone. Let's see.
Well, I had former American Idol contestant Scott McIntyre sing over the phone, and he sounded great.
Oh, wow, he was wonderful. Yeah, okay, well, what should I sing? I will sing one verse of the Leonard Cohen Hallelujah. How about that?
Okay.
Okay, so it goes like this. I did my best. It wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I tried to touch. I told the truth. I didn't come to fool you. And even though it all went wrong, I stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my tongue but hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
Bravo, bravo. Well, you inspire our listeners, especially those who want to seek music careers, to face their challenges and achieve their dreams. We're running out of time, but thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to staying in touch.
For more information on Lori Rubin, her albums,
new book,
and upcoming performances, go to www.lori-rubin.com. And to purchase Lori's handcrafted jewelry, go to www.thelrlook.com.
That's all for this edition of Speaking Out for the Blind. Thanks for listening, and remember to speak out.
You're listening to American Council for the Blind Radio.
By the blind, for the world.